fucking turn it on. Turn it on, man.
Just, I know. Let's just start the podcast already. Yeah. That can be the start of it.
Okay, it's running for sure.
Okay, good. Okay.
Fucking hell.
Hello again. This is episode number 6.
Or sex in Swedish.
Right. Precis. Actually, precis. Post-production, Anna's here. Please forgive Ashley's bad joke. She was super excited and happy because she got really good feedback on her first paper. So that was amazing. This episode is really long, so I just want to give you a short TLDR, if you will. We talk about the worst and at the same time best enzyme on the planet. Then we have kind of a summary of the scientific decade, spanning from gravitational waves to gene editing. And in the end, we have a few small topics like the use of criminalized drugs as antidepressants, what to do when time traveling as a scientist, and rats are driving cars now. Enjoy. I'm here again with Chris and Ashley, and this time we're going to do something we never did before, which is introduce ourselves.
Way.
I'm Hannes. I'm a PhD student in biochemistry, and I'm on the side. Next to my PhD, I'm running the Pfizer website, and since recently with mainly Chris, Ashley, and hopefully soon other people, I'm hosting the Pfizer podcast, where you have informal conversations about science, things in the community, and as today, just stuff we find interesting.
Cool. Hi, I'm Chris. I'm a postdoc in chemistry in the Karolinska Institute. I mainly make small molecules, nanoparticles, and biomaterials for regenerative medicine.
It sounds so impressive. Now I have to go. Hello, my name is Ashley. I'm also a PhD student here at the Karolinska Institute. But I am a psychiatric epidemiologist and psychiatric geneticist, which is basically just a really fancy way of saying that I study mental illnesses at the population level. Yeah.
Oh, thank God we got that over with. Can we have the beers now?
Absolutely have the beer.
Sweet.
Awesome.
Cheers.
Let's get this started.
Skål.
Cheers.
Skål. Prost, nicht?
Symbol.
Today we want to do the things a bit different, and we didn't actually prepare a topic as before, where we never actually scripted things, and I don't think we would ever. And today it's even less scripted. We each prepared one or two topics that we found interesting, something I read or just stumbled upon recently, at least on my side. On Chris's side, it might be a bit different. And we're just going to talk about it, see where it goes, and have it like a collection of short topics that we individually found interesting and maybe want to have a conversation about.
Yeah, and if you or any of the listeners want to interject, or if we get something wrong, please add your comments to the PlaySci website and the...
And that's the Anchor Podcast app, which takes voice messages, so we can actually just put your voice message into the podcast in the next episode and comment on it.
Yeah.
Or any other kind of written medium. Awesome. Should I start with the first thing?
Mm-hmm. Go for it, yeah.
So what I found recently, again, is an enzyme. Well, I didn't actually find it. Yeah, it's something I learned about in my second semester in... I think I had one lecture on... like one whole course on plant physiology and biochemistry or something like that. So I didn't find it super interesting back in the day. And I remember this one lecture where the professor talked about an enzyme called Rubisco. Does it mean anything to you?
No.
Great. Well, I wanted to introduce it anyway. Because it's at the same time the worst and the most important enzyme on the planet, I want to say.
Bold statement?
Bold statement. Which one do you want to hear first? The bad part or the good part?
Bad part.
That part. Awesome. So Rubisco catalyzes the carbon fixation in plants. Plants take CO2 from the air and incorporate it into their sugars. So that's how mm-hmm. the CO2 from the atmosphere enters the plant, and they kind of eat it in a way, even though it's gaseous.
Mm-hmm.
Which is obviously a super important reaction. But it's really bad at doing this. The turnover rate of this enzyme is 1 to 10 molecules per second, which maybe doesn't mean a lot to many people. Maybe Ashley, I don't know. But this is super slow for an enzyme. Many enzymes have turnover rates of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of molecules per second, which is, I guess, in the time scale of regular chemical reactions. Chris agrees?
Pretty good.
Yes. Yeah. Rubisco does 1 to 10 per second, and while doing this, it has a 20, depending on the environment and plant, 20 to 40% error rate,
where it incorporates an oxygen molecule instead of a CO2 molecule into this sugar molecule.
Huh.
This leads to a toxic molecule for the plant, and with an error rate of roughly 30%, this is insanely high, right? You can imagine the molecule produced, the faulty molecule produced is very similar to the actual molecule. So it fits in many enzymatic pockets on the pathway and therefore inhibits them and is therefore toxic to the plant. And 30% of the total energy production of the cell, of the plant, goes into fixing these mistakes. I think that's amazing. It's the shittiest enzyme ever. And at the same time, the most abundant enzyme on the planet.
Hmm.
Wow.
And for us and for all of life, the most important enzyme, because it takes carbon dioxide from the air and makes life out of it. 90% of all inorganic carbon that enters the biosphere, so life and everything about it, comes from this very enzyme, Rubisco. I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
That is super cool.
Is it the enzymes error? So the rate that the enzymes fixing CO2 is also limited by the amount of energy absorbed by the photosynthetic complex that absorbs the light and that absorbs the photon. So is it the actual turnover rate of that enzyme, or is it the slow, relatively inefficient trapping of the photon to reduce the carbon dioxide that's limiting it?
I'm not entirely sure if the photosynthesis pathway is directly involved in this.
Mm.
I don't think it is. I might be wrong. But no, the enzyme is just slow by its own fault.
Mm-mm.
It's not pathway dependent. I read a bit about it, so I don't know why it came up recently again. It just popped up in my mind, Rubisco is kind of funny. Mm-hmm. And so I started reading again. And one of the things I found why it might be so slow is because the slower an enzyme works, purely thermodynamically, the more specific it is in general. And the other way around, the faster an enzyme is, the higher the error rate. That makes sense for you from a physical chemistry perspective?
I've never heard it stated like that. I really would have to read up and think quite carefully about that statement, because I think it must be... it must be reaction, like specific to reactions. I'm not sure you could make such a general statement, but sure, for now, let's go with it. Yeah,
I think in protein biochemistry, that's something which people generally accept. If you want your reaction to happen more specifically with less side products, you perform it at 4 degrees or something. And if you want to have it just fast, you speed up the temperature to the optimum of the protein. Of course, not beyond that, because then it's going to fall apart.
Mm.
Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Just go with
it. Sure. Yeah, I'm going to go with it. It's fine.
And so why I think this is super exciting, especially for modern times, is because it traps carbon from the air and what makes it to something solid. And it's something we struggle with a lot. And you talked about this in our second podcast when you said, I can't recall the exact words, this is what life makes so amazingly well, is trapping carbon from the air and putting it into something usable, which is what we completely fail at.
Hmm. Definitely, yeah. We're getting better at it now. More and more carbon trapping technologies are emerging. But still, it's hard to beat just growing trees. Definitely.
Sorry, can I ask you a little bit more about what the current carbon capturing technologies are?
So you can react. So there's two stages. One is to take CO2 and turn it into something useful. And so there's quite a few reactions that work. You might have a catalyst and hydrogen around to reduce the carbon dioxide into a sort of an alkene, or just even to methane, releasing water as well. So taking the oxygens off it and turning that into water and putting the hydrogen onto the carbon to making methane. These are sort of industrial catalysts that are used. Other types of them are used in the petroleum industry and stuff like that. And there's lots and lots of research going on that side of things.
Mm-hmm.
The other question is, to use those catalysts, they need 100% pure CO2 usually to go into the reaction vessel. And of course, it's only very low content in the atmosphere. It's like 3% or something, 2%?
CO2?
CO2. Oh,
I think much, much lower. 0.6 or 0.06. I'm going to add in the exact number here.
0.04%.
Super low. And that's impossible for us to pump into these reactions to get them to go. So there's another thing with carbon dioxide capture, either from straight air, or it's more easier to capture it, say, from a power plant gas emissions. And that's the big thing, is now trying to trap the CO2 down. And there are these cool molecules called MOFs that can trap. They've got like a very high surface area, so they can trap CO2 quite well. Or you just have a big bucket of a base, so usually like methylamine or some sort of amine, and you bubble the CO2 in. It gets it coordinates to the base, and then you keep bubbling it through until it's full up. You take your CO2 trap amine thing and you boil it, you heat it up, and the CO2 bubbles back off again in another place. And so all the CO2 comes off. You then have a like pure stream of CO2, and you can go and do stuff with it. But big problem is everything you do with it requires energy, either electricity, which we tend to generate via fossil fuels, or hydrogen or something like this, which pretty much we keep making hydrogen from fossil fuels. So we haven't fixed the problem yet where we can eliminate the CO2 from the atmosphere without putting more CO2 back into the atmosphere. But that's eventually, if you hooked up a wind farm, hopefully that would fix the problem. But we're still not very good at it. And it's kind of cheaper and easier just to plant a big forest and trap it that way.
What I wonder is if one day, and a lot of accelerated evolution down the road, if we can get to a system where Rubisco is much better than it is today in trapping carbon, significantly faster, because we know enzymes can do that, right? And this way find some kind of industrial application for it. And I'm sure people are thinking about that. I think there is research going this direction, definitely. But so far, no one really got very, very far with it.
I've seen some PopSci articles about people who have... It was really, really bad internet comment. Like, something like, people have hacked photosynthesis. Like, I don't know, MIT researchers have hacked photosynthesis. And the claim was that they had either engineered the enzyme... So again, I don't know if it's the light capturing or the CO2 sequestering parts, but they'd increase the efficiency of a plant artificially to trap to grow, and had improved the yield of the crop. So maybe they're working on those sorts of things.
Yes, there are also artificial pathways. So the pathway that's capturing CO2 in plants is called, I think, Calvin cycle. And there are artificial ways to make that. I think the catch cycle is one of the fanciest one right now, where I have no idea how it works, and I do not feel very motivated to look it up right now. But what I read is that they improved the efficiency of this carbon capturing process by 5 times, and I think that's kind of amazing.
Cool.
Moving on. What does any one of you have? What did you bring, Chris?
So I troll the internet reading trashy PopSci articles quite a lot and calling it research. One thing came up on my feed, which was talking about the top 5 research discoveries of the decade. And I don't know. So I'll just tell you the list, and then I want you guys to comment on it and see, I don't know, I don't necessarily agree with all of them, but it'd be interesting to see which ones you agree with and disagree with. The first one was CRISPR-Cas9, bit of a poster boy for you just have to put that in a grant to get it funded, or in a paper to get it.
For sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exoplanets, been discovering loads of exoplanets recently. There was also gravitational waves and Higgs boson. And
yeah, I gotta pretend they're new to me, but I did actually read the list. The fifth one was...
Well, obviously it wasn't that good, if we can't remember it.
No, it was actually climate change.
Climate change, oh yeah.
Which, yeah, I guess that's why we cannot find the word.
Yeah.
It's not really a discovery. If we just start with that one...
Yeah.
What do you feel like, Ashley? Which one should we talk about?
Yeah, I think climate change is pretty big.
And I think because what you just said is CRISPR-Cas is one of the big buzzwords in at least life science right now. CRISPR-Cas. Climate change is the big buzzword in anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It might be biased, of course, to my reads before, but my newsfeed is full of climate change articles. So maybe this was just a way of getting the article more into them, more out there.
Yeah.
It's not a discovery, right?
That's my problem with it.
I think that it's just become so overwhelmingly obvious, like even on like a personal level to a lot of people, that, hey, like our winters are not the same anymore. Even this November in like Stockholm, I don't know if you guys have also felt that. But
years ago.
Yeah, it's totally different. Like when I moved here 2 years ago, it feels like it took a lot longer for it to get to the temperature it is now, which is like, you know, around 0 degrees. And our snowfall felt quite late to me. But then again, like I said, I've only been living here for 2 years. So perhaps it's like, and this is just like an anomaly.
So if you're talking about this very heavy snowfall in September 2016 in Stockholm, sorry, November 2016, or if you basically try to make a climate change argument about one single data point, which would be this number then, this doesn't really work because we still have low temperatures.
Yeah.
The October this year in Sweden was particularly cold. This particular November from 3 years ago was the coldest, I think the heaviest snowfall Stockholm has seen in 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
I know that because I arrived the week after and I saw the news from Germany. It's like, oh my goodness, it's got to be horrible. Well, it kind of was because I had to like drag my suitcases over the snow. It was still piles of snow next to the street. It was kind of very beautiful, but not very nice to travel in.
I don't...
Yep. Sorry, I just want to add that, like, yeah, so global warming is not just... not just that there's no cold temperatures, it's just that there's a general instability in the weather and that the like global average like temperature is slowly increasing at a much faster rate than we would expect from previous data.
That's why we started calling it climate change and not global warming.
Yeah.
So, not to get political about this, but I feel like this does a great disservice to Al Gore, because he did I just looked it up, actually. The film An Inconvenient Truth about climate change was 2006. So... We've known about climate change for a long time. I don't think it's been suddenly discovered in 2010.
So should we just discard this point as, okay, this was just another point to make for climate change, which is great. I think people should know about it and should. You cannot hear it too often. On the other hand, scientific discovery-wise, not a great point.
No, because the evidence keeps building for it, and the ice core data gets better and better, and other sort of the polar orbiter satellites can track the ice sheet moving and changing, but I don't think the fundamental insight is any different from 10, 20 years
ago. Exactly. Maybe it's just more pressing right now than it ever was before.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong because I only lived in the last 3 decades, but could be.
I think there was
talk to the dinosaurs. They got.
they might have sense.
They suffered from climate change before.
I think I think there's actually talks going on in the 70s already about it.
Absolutely.
Actually, yeah.
Yes.
There's huge evidence that the oil companies knew about it as a risk to their profits way earlier, and they identified that they needed to hide the debate on it.
It's just like leaded gas versus unleaded gas. Oil companies knew for a very long time in the U.S. that leaded gas, releasing leaded gas, causes all kinds of issues in the population. But then they just tried to hide it, you know, from the population. And they did like this, you know, they went through crazy lawsuits trying to get the information, trying to keep the information hidden. And it wasn't until like maybe a decade or two after... It was until a decade or two that they later admitted, we probably shouldn't have done this, and here's a bunch of unleaded gas for the world.
What is that gas?
Unleaded versus leaded gas. So, like, releasing
lead, PB?
From my understanding, actually, we should look that up, though, before so I...
It's tetraethyl lead.
Okay.
Looking it up right now.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so we should let the chemist talk about this, not the psychiatric epidemiologist.
And psychiatric
genesis. Yes, indeed. But it did cause a lot of psychiatric problems, so that's my little tip of the hat.
There's a distinct like drop in the rate of violent homicide after the out of the cut phase out of leaded petrol. It's insane. It's like a really, it's correlation, not causation, maybe.
Yes, but absolutely.
It's a beautiful graph where it just goes like tetraethyl lead stops being used and then doom, goes down.
Is this a great segue for the next proper podcast about causation and correlation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we should definitely talk about that. But I mean, yeah, it's the effects of lead. I mean, I think there actually have been studies to the effects of lead, and
Absolutely.
We can talk about that more later. Maybe we can throw in a little bitty insert segment about some of the effects that we found. But anyway, yeah.
So when I said let's just start this topic 3 minutes ago, you decided this is not going to happen. We're going to keep talking about it.
It's a great topic.
It's so interesting, though, right?
Yeah. I just want to bring up...
Take your time, Chris.
There's a chemist, and he developed... He's, like, one of the worst people... Well, worst chemists in the sense that he popularized the use of tetraethyl lead and invented, like, fluorocarbons. So two of the most, like, toxic and hazardous chemicals, not, like, widely used hazardous chemicals, he developed and championed their use. And I was trying to look up his name. We will add it in now.
And that chemist's name is Thomas Midgley Jr.
Yeah. Glad I know that now.
Yeah.
What a jerk.
Don't do that. Yeah.
Next point. What I found interesting in that list is that two of them... The discovery of the Higgs boson and the confirmation of gravitational waves both move towards this unified field theory, because it's... I know very little about fundamental physics, so I'm way out of my comfort zone here, but I'm going to give it a shot. So in the... It is, so far we have four forces of the universe, right? We have the strong and the weak force and electromagnetism, which completely combine nicely with our quantum field theory and, am I going too far? At least quantum electrodynamics is what combines all of those. And then there is gravitation, specifically through Einstein's relativity theory. And those four forces cannot be combined. Especially gravitation cannot be combined with the other three. And the standard model system we have of all of the nice particles, which is like quarks and electrons and, well, there's a whole zoo of them, right? There was no particle for gravitation. It was proposed, it was derived mathematically, proposed by this Higgs guy, and then confirmed 2012 in the CERN supercollider. Might be wrong with some of the details, but I think that's the gist of it. Chris, you're shaking your head. What's going on?
I'm trying to... So I know it's the Higgs boson imparts mass. So it's the difference between like a photon and an electron somehow. And is that purely about the mass in the sense of gravitational attraction between the two? Or does it have other... like, because the mass of the electron comes into play in the nucleus where gravitation doesn't occur. So is it definitely linked between gravitation and the Higgs boson?
Yeah. I am fairly certain it is. I think it's supposed to explain the attraction between massive particles, so particles containing mass, like excluding the photon, but including electron, quark-derived particles like neutron, proton, and so on. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it's there for.
This wasn't too bad, but also not quite what it was about. So the discovery of the Higgs boson proved basically the Higgs field, which is one of these universal fields present throughout the entire universe as predicted from quantum field theory. This is actually quite complex, and I don't want to get into the details here, so I will link some YouTube videos, and you can just go ahead and check it out from someone who actually knows more about the topic than I do.
The gravitational waves is a very similar thing, which I do not fully understand. All I do know is it wasn't discovered through the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, but through this, what's it called, Leica? It's a gigantic interferometer. And what I find fascinating about it is that it's the same kind of machine people use in Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy, just like miles large. Kind of fun because I don't know.
I love it.
But I still don't know much about it.
I have all these things where they're discovered using these giant, absolutely giant machines. Like CERN is the biggest machine ever created.
The biggest machine built. And right now they're building a bigger one. Or they plan to build a bigger one in Switzerland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's going to be exciting.
Nice.
I guess. I still don't know much about it then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the gravitational waves thing, I think, confirmed another prediction of Einstein's relativity theory. So maybe that's actually not so much towards unified field theory. So maybe the...
Doesn't unified field theory have to take into account relativity? It's not if it's going to work. So that,
yes,
that does help.
So I'm not sure if it helps. If it just confirms relativity as it is. And we know it's not complete, right?
Mm.
And this was basically the same thing with the picture of the black hole, which I kind of expected to be in the same list. Cause
it is a cool picture.
It is, yeah, it's very blurry though.
Go and find a picture of a black hole, you do better.
Okay.
What are you writing now?
It's this one, right? Where it's like...
Yeah, exactly.
The one from the film.
Interstellar.
Interstellar.
Yeah.
It's so brave how Matthew McConaughey volunteered to go into the black hole. Like, he had so much to lose.
He didn't even get top 5 greatest scientific discoveries, and he went into a black hole. That's terrible.
Matthew McConaughey has children, and I still did not buy that he was a father any time during his performance. Matthew McConaughey could not act his way out of a paper bag, and I say that as a fellow Texan. I hope he's not a fan of the podcast.
I really like Matthew McConaughey, so we'll cut this now. We'll have a separate podcast on the... In fact, we can probably do like a multi-part series about him. So
Bless his heart.
I do not have an opinion on this, and I will veto that.
You can be the moderator. Schism in science has created
back to the black hole. Would you mind to go back to the black hole, Ashley? Or do you want to keep talking about this Matthew person?
We can go back to the black hole, I guess.
In a way, black holes have been confirmed a while ago, I think, through this Stephen Hawking's person, definitely have an opinion on.
They've definitely detected the Hawking radiation from the black hole.
Yes. So in a way, I think the gravitational waves are a bigger thing because the experiment confirmed their very existence, which couldn't be proven so far, while the black hole picture just gave a visual representation of something that we knew was there already.
Mm.
And the specific shape that it just drew on the whiteboard, which the listeners can't see right now, confirmed the bending of the light. So it confirmed the prediction relativity theory made about how light works close to a black hole. So that was kind of nice, I think. And like if you watch YouTube at the time, people predict, show the prediction. You can either see this or this, depending on how the disk is angled to the actual hole. This the disk of this dust and stuff. So I think this was kind of nice. It was a great example of how science works and how you have your prediction and your exclusion also of what you're not going to see. So I think it was a very good example of science done this year, but maybe not one of the grand discoveries. Maybe that's why it wasn't in there.
Is there any effect of gravitational waves to our life on Earth? Or is it mostly have to do with the existence around black holes and the theory of relativity?
I've heard, and again, this might be completely wrong, but mm-hmm. I think they've been seeing inconsistencies with the orbits of satellites, and I think they've been sort of, the better our predictive models of gravitational waves, the better we can predict how the satellites are going to be perturbed by big interstellar changes and those mm-hmm. sort of things. So it will in some way affect us, but I think much, much longer term.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But there is possibly some slight tangible use for these things.
One thing I've read is that gravitational waves are basically ripples in the space-time, right? Is that how they describe it? And they kind of move space apart, which also means it moves matter apart, mm-hmm. which we all are. I think their creation to a measurable amount is very rare. Which was the one that we measured? Was like a neutron star merger? That's two neutron stars, these super heavy objects,
mm-hmm.
like the second heaviest after black holes. And when they merge, they release this enormous energy. And this we could measure as gravitational waves. And I think what people predicted, or something that could happen if heavier neutron stars were to merge, not sure to what extent, or maybe black holes, and here I really don't know what I'm talking about anymore. We could experience much, much stronger gravitational waves that could actually destroy things. And this article, I have no idea how credible this was. They said gigantic gravitational waves could destroy the planet altogether. And this is one of these horror scenarios. I don't know if this is true or not.
Mm-hmm.
If objects like this were to release gravitational waves of this magnitude, maybe I'm wrong. But this is something I've heard. I cannot say if this is true or not.
I think that's your point, Ashley, is really valid. It's something I was feeling when I was reading this list was these are good to know. It's like it's nice to know our place in the universe and that black holes have that shape and it's a pretty picture.
There's inherent value in that, I would say.
Well,
yeah.
Matthew McConaughey. But
oh my God.
But otherwise, there's not a tangible value. Whereas the CRISPR-Cas9 discovery, because people are... I think treatments are in the process of being commercialized, at least. I don't think there's one out on the market yet, but...
No, I think there are things.
Already? Gosh.
Yeah. Well, before we talk about it in detail, we should explain it briefly.
No, it's just that, yeah, should we evaluate this list based on, like, real-world impact or impact to ourselves? Or, like, is it just good for humanity to know that we have now discovered this and, you know, that sort of thing?
Comes down to the question, what is science good for?
Absolutely nothing. Oh.
Whoa.
Shit.
Kind of pays our salary, right?
Oh, yeah, brilliant. We should keep going with this.
Yes, awesome.
To everyone who's funding us, it's brilliant. Let's not question it.
Well, again, I'm going to defend my point. Science is good for two things. To increase the body of human knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you cannot do anything with it, at least we know more than we did before we did the experiment. So that's cool. And then for advances in technology, medicine, and all of that.
Mm.
And if we sort it in these categories, climate change, human impact more than anything else, impact on our life and our planet.
Mm. Sure.
It's not really super interesting to know about it, right? But it's definitely important to do something.
It's a semantic argument about the word discovery, I would say.
Well, yeah, okay, let's maybe discard this again. Then we have the Higgs boson, and I don't think we can ever do anything with it. I might be wrong. I hope in like 1,000 years time people prove me wrong when they
build
wormholes or something. But for now, it's not really good for much. Same for gravitational waves, I want to say. Of course, there was technological applications for quantum mechanics and relativity theory. And like satellites account for the relativistic effects of being further away from the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And these things, and quantum mechanics, of course, tons of technological applications.
I mean, it's huge in chemistry. We need, when we come to modeling systems and these sorts of things, we need...
Yeah, real life, Chris, not chemistry. Oh, of course, it's just working inside. Breaking out of the scientific bubble, I know it's hard for us. And then the fourth discovery they talked about was exoplanets. Okay, let me quickly bring in CRISPR before, which is not super interesting to know about, because the actual knowledge was from the 90s of how this works. And only recently people started to apply it to something, and there is only for technological advancement. And exoplanets, well, one could claim we could move there.
Yeah, we might need a Higgs boson drive to get our ships over to them, but yeah, sure.
Yeah, I guess exoplanets are... Their discovery is more through technological advances and not really because we like discovered them, right?
No, it was statistically likely that they existed, right?
Yeah, and we had now had the technology how to discover them.
Hmm. They're not alone in the universe.
Well, they are more exoplanets. I guess we hypothesized that before.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is the definition of an exoplanet? And how did we discover them?
Chris, do you want to lean out of your comfort zone or should I first?
I mean, I think this is the comfort zone I have about exoplanets. They are planets orbiting stars that are not our own. So we've now seen that they kind of, you can see the perturbation in the light from a star, and it looks like planets are moving. It can be modeled as a planet moving around or orbiting around that star. And through maths, they have also discovered that these planets are in the same they're the same distance from the sun as ours, or same distance from a star, a sun-type star as ours, and they can be rocky balls. And so they look Earth-like to as good as we can.
So when people say that we've found planets that could potentially harbor life, is that what they're talking about? Or is that...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, it's like it's likely because it looks a lot like what we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with anything you said, other than you said there's one measure of how we can confirm the existence of an exoplanet, which is the shadow of it's moving through the light the star emits to us. This only works if the exoplanet's orbit is actually in plane with our line of sight, I guess. But if it's tilted, you wouldn't see the planet moving through our line of vision or line of sight. And then I think something that can be done if the planet is massive enough, and I think this only works for planets the size of Jupiter onwards, is measuring the tiny perturbance of the star's position through its own gravitational drag, basically. And this way you can... It's another way of indirectly measuring if there's an exoplanet or not. I think there are more ways which I forgot about. And also most of them I wouldn't even understand. What I don't know is how we can get spectral information on their atmosphere, because apparently people know about this as well. And the actual distance, because this isn't given through either of the methods. No, I think there is ways to calculate that, which I don't.
It seems like there probably are methods to do that.
Well, obviously there are, because people claim to know.
I mean, yeah.
Okay. Back into a comfort zone. CRISPR-Cas. CRISPR is basically a way of cutting DNA in a very specific place. But this was actually a major discovery because this is super difficult. It has always been difficult the last decades where gene editing was a gigantic effort and now it's a matter of weeks and the success rate is very high and the off-target rate, which means unspecific leavages, so to do damage to the DNA in places where you don't want to do it, is very low. This is through molecular features of the enzyme that works there and has like an RNA guide that specifically tells the protein where to cut the DNA. But in the end, it's just a fancy way of slicing DNA. And then we can introduce a new gene or inactivate a gene just by cutting it in a specific position. That's what it's about. Have you heard of CRISPR, Ashley? You're not in the field of life sciences, does it?
No, I've heard of. I'm in the realm. I actually met the people that did CRISPR at a conference. Oh. So, hair flip. Speaking of sanctifying researchers.
Wow.
Yeah. No, it was hosted at the department where they have it. I can't remember the department name right now. It's this name.
That department was the Broad Institute in Boston, Massachusetts.
But yeah, that's where they hosted the Behavioral Genetics Association conference. And so there's like a lot of people that work within CRISPR and stuff. And it's pretty cool. There's a big two research institutes, like basically quote unquote discovered it at the same time. And there was a big like dick swinging context. Sorry, you're going to say something, Chris?
Yeah, I was going to say patent battle, but dick swing contest is the better.
It is literally just one big ego fight there, and I'm sure they're all very lovely people, and I understand wanting the significance of having your name associated with it.
I have the money for sure.
Yeah. What, sorry?
This patent war is epic.
Oh, yeah.
There is a lot of money behind this.
Is it still going on, or have they made
this? I think it's still going on.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like they don't got the money. So anyway,
I'm still intrigued how that could work, the patent, because now it's everyone knows of CRISPR-Cas9,
yeah,
and all this other stuff. So do you consider that prior art, or does someone have to read it? Like everything now, every drug sold with CRISPR-Cas9, they'll have to pay backdated royalties to whenever they sought this patent.
I think they don't, and I've heard that this is a really golden time for CRISPR-related companies to rise, because right now the intellectual property is not protected. So right now you can do whatever you want, but as soon as the patent is granted to either of those parties, from there on, we'll have to pay royalties, but not right now. So if any one of you guys is up for starting a company, well, I was looking at the two people on the podcast with me, but if one of your listeners is up and needs a...
Should we call it Crispy?
Nice.
The Crisps.
Maybe we could genetically engineer rice and then we could call it Rice Krispies.
And I mean, of course, we're already seeing like some really interesting real world effects. Even just kind of to delve into my own field, there was a Chinese scientist recently that got in trouble for performing CRISPR on fetuses to prevent them from getting HIV. And they were healthy born girls, and they're living in China right now. And of course, this opens up huge quandaries. And Chris, you have an opinion that you'd like to share.
I may be jumping in too early here.
No, it's okay. Please do.
I like how your vocal response is so much milder than your physical response. You just start with waving your arms.
So we're very cordial here at this in the podcast room. Super cordial. Go ahead, Chris. Sorry.
The tone of the way you're introducing this sounds like this was a good thing.
Oh no, it's awful. Yeah. It's horrifying, and there's real world horrifying things, and I can go on a long rant, and it's especially potent in my field that we go on this rant. So go ahead and finish.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I think
this
I just
is awful.
Got the wrong end of the stick.
No.
It was kind of calm and like this is another cool discovery. Which...
No, it is a bad thing to do.
Yeah,
horrid
and,
thing
and
to do.
The phrase "they were healthy people" or babies. May not be true. Hannah said it was quite a specific way of introducing the cuts and adding in the other genetic sequences. But the most recent thing I read was that they've had a look back at some of his, so it's an unpublished paper that they've managed to find, like get some, one of his collaborators has put it out on the web for people to comment on. And the recent reviews of this are, it's horrifying, and that they haven't conferred HIV immunity to the babies, and they may have caused a lot of other random mutations around that area, which we don't know what they're going to do. So it's awful.
By healthy, sorry, just to clarify, by healthy I meant they did not die shortly after birth. They were living.
Yeah.
Not that they are healthy in every other physical way.
As far as I know, we also don't know who or where they are.
I don't
think these babies are located.
And this is a huge thing about science. Like, if you do some, if you say you've done something and you provide no evidence for the fact you've done it, did you actually do it?
Another really crucial thing to add, why this is so important, is because, okay, let's say that these babies manage to live a relatively normal life, relatively healthy, quote unquote, life. Let's decide they have children of their own. These effects can be passed on to their children and their children and their children, and this could fundamentally disrupt humanity. And I don't mean to say that facetiously, but truly that's the capability of this technology. We need to wield it very carefully, especially because we are really in the infancy stages of what we know about genetic and genetic effects. And at least in my field, we still have not gotten to the point where we can, you know, fundamentally say, okay, this person will definitely develop schizophrenia. This person will definitely have a high IQ. This person this person could have a low IQ. And so my concern is that there's going to start being this selection, for example, of embryos with this certain, you know, genetic risk score, polygenic risk score for, let's just say, like high IQ. But really, it's not what we think it does. And then we can cause all sorts of havoc in future generations. That's irreversible.
The other question is using it on animals, other animals, like farm animals and these sorts of things. And like just without technically like molecular genetic engineering, we've managed to produce animals that have a horrible existence. Like they're too fat or they grow too much too quickly. They have very bad bone mass or whatever these things are. And if we use these technologies to push the food, like make a chicken just chicken breast or something like this, those sort of welfare questions and these sorts of things is going to be horrific. So what could be done is pretty scary.
Yeah, I think just to piggyback off your point, I recently read an article that chickens nowadays in these factory farms have to be killed by a certain week, because at a certain point they're too fat for their legs to carry them, and their legs will literally snap.
It's awful.
Which is horrifying.
How does it relate to the CRISPR point?
So we're talking
horrible damage or horrible suffering to animals through breeding, and you think it might be even worse with genetic engineering?
Well, it's not that. It's just that, I mean, things can go unethical very quickly, I think was the point we were trying to make, just with, like, the animal husbandry and things. Like, it's at a certain point, like, you know, is it ethical? But I guess I don't want to get into that too much, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that we can do untold damage to future generations and just in general humanity by just not fully understanding the power that we wield.
And the mistake we make is self-replicating. So it's not like a chem like tetraethyl lead, which goes into the environment, and then that one molecule of tetraethyl lead eventually decomposes and we can stop using tetraethyl lead and the problem goes away. If we make a mutation that causes some problem, but it's beneficial to the organism that we put it in, that will replicate across the planet, and there's no stopping it in that sense. So we have to be careful.
Is it a point for you guys to not do it at all, or to discuss when we do it, or to discuss, I guess that's what it's going to be in the end, every individual case very thoroughly?
I think there needs to be a line drawn. Okay, is this supposed to be an enhancement to humanity, or is this to prevent suffering? So, for example, if we already know there's like a really like severe genetic disorder that we can prevent, then yes, I do think it's ethical to do that. But then you have a question of the haves versus the have-nots. So, of course, people from rich Western countries will no longer have this disease, but then maybe a poorer family or a poor country will still be afflicted by this disease, which is not really fair. But then I think all enhancements to humanity should be banned. All genetic enhancements to humanity should be banned, because it's just going to create. Well, I mean, think about the alternative. I mean, if it's, I mean, I hate to go there, but it's like sort of the Ubermensch all over again. If you have a group of people that are told their whole lives, okay, you're genetically superior because we were able to engineer you in the womb to be, you know, this super high IQ, you know, super quote unquote beautiful embryo. I mean, that's going to create like a different class of people. Do you know what I mean?
I understand your point, but I don't think I necessarily agree. Because
thank you for turning off your vibration.
Oh, sorry. I also just want to add really quickly. Sorry, it's not that these people will be inherently better, but just more that it can create a more unequal class and a more unequal society. That's the point I'm trying to make here.
Which are two very different things. One thing would be, we might be able to, or we would want to improve whatever abilities, but we fail at it because the science isn't good enough. And the other one is we are successfully doing it, and then we create a second class, which we don't want.
The science is not there yet. I just want to quickly add, the science is definitely not there yet where we can do these types of things. But in the future, in like, you know, 50 to 100 years, I mean, likely, honestly, the science will be maybe not quite there, but it will likely be there. And then I still don't think it's ethical to do it.
I'm very much in two minds, because I agree with the ethical point about a two-tier society, but I also am intrigued to know what humanity could become with enhancements. So there is evidence that we can improve our cognition, either using small molecules or via genetic therapies and these sorts of things. And if our brains at the moment are only able to understand so much about the universe, if we improve ourselves and we are clever, either possibly with like mind-computer interfaces and these sorts of things, what possibly could we do, and what discoveries could be made? I'm not sure we want to limit ourselves at any point, and then who knows what we will become. So I think that's like a very futuristic kind of point. Like I really enjoy reading sci-fi. I like the idea that eventually stuff will be better and we will improve everything.
Yeah, I think it's also kind of, this is kind of a fundamentally philosophical question, like, do we allow sort of the strongest among us to sort of push forward and barrel forward, or do we kind of, like, you know, all hold hands and go forward as a group? I think that's a really interesting question. Go ahead.
I think what you're basically worried about is that it's going to increase the split between society or humanity in total. And I think this is a very valid point. Chris's argument is ignoring this and saying we as a society, as humankind, can develop further for everyone. And that's, of course, less realistic because, of course, there is this gigantic gap of wealth and everything I don't want to get into now. The question is, can we improve humanity altogether without leaving 80% behind?
Wanted to kind of follow on from that, I suppose it's a general thing of, are you hopeful about technology or are you fearful about technology?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it's kind of, it's hard to conceive of, like, right now we think our lives are pretty good, but what would have people thought 50 years ago if we told them that we can communicate instantly using a thing in our pockets and, you know, we're constantly sharing stuff on this giant meta collection of all of our information. Like, would people have been like, oh, that would be terrible, that would have been awful, it would create, you know, subsections of society that would fight, and which we're kind of seeing with trolls and internet flame wars and stuff like this. So actually, maybe it has come to pass. Oh dear, oh well.
Maybe. This was an intense wrap-up of the science, at least these five scientific discoveries of the last decade. Did you guys miss something?
I was trying to think about this, and again, of course, it's going to be chemistry related. It's quite difficult to pick something that's actually only been discovered in the this last decade. Like, it's a lot like the CRISPR-Cas9 stuff, where...
In chemistry, you mean?
I'm particularly focused on chemistry, but whatever, like, most stuff has been you can see evidence of it in the literature before, but it's only become useful in the last decades, these sorts of things. So it's not technically a discovery of the last decade, which makes the whole list quite difficult to do. But I suppose the one thing I did identify was definitely the rise of quantum computing, and there's a whole computational discovery and use of this architecture, which is cool, but there's a distinct chemical and chemistry discoveries that had to happen in order for Google to make their new quantum computer. They have to trap a particular molecule that can exist in a superposition of states, and read out that molecule, read whether it's up, down, or undetermined.
Can you tell me more about this molecule? Because I don't know anything about it, I think.
Right, I don't know either. Well, it's not that I don't know. Sorry. There are like three or four competing technologies at the moment for how you trap the single molecule in these things and how you read them out. NMR is one of those ways of reading out the spin state, although it's not very high throughput. You can only really tell one thing or a bulk spin state rather than an individual spin state. So I think they now trap, I'm going to say nitrogen into a silicon chip, and then the nitrogen spin, like N15 or something like that, the spin can be altered and manipulated to give you your quantum qubit that has the three positions rather than two. And that takes a lot of very, very particular chemistry to manage to do these sorts of things. And I think that's only come in really recently. So it's awesome.
I think what you just mentioned before, to go back like a minute or two, is that a preliminary discovery has been made a long time ago, and now people started seeing use in it or something like that. What we saw in these physical discoveries, so in physics, gravitational waves and the Higgs boson, are things that have been postulated a long time ago but couldn't be proven experimentally for technical and machine reasons and things like that. While in chemistry, and in the case of CRISPR, also biology, people found something a long time ago, described it, and then did not care about it any longer. And then decades later, someone saw a use for it and then started using it again. Do you think this is very common? Is it the, is it as common in physics, or is it more a trademark of chemistry and biology, maybe?
I mean, it comes down to the question of, it is postulating an existence the discovery of that thing, or no. No. So, like, with quantum computing, the postulation of quantum computers was made quite a while ago, but the actual inaction, like, making quantum computers has only occurred in the last 10 years, that actually can perform computational processes using the qubit. And it's the same with chemistry. I suppose that we've known about spin states of certain items, certain molecules, certain atoms, and it's only been in the last 10 years that we've exploited those spin states to create the quantum computer. So it's very difficult to draw a line and be like, this is when it was discovered, this is the point of inception.
Well, for gravitational waves and Higgs boson, there's one specific point where it was discovered, one where it was postulated. But to be honest, physicists postulate a lot of things, especially about the Big Bang, particles and virtual particles. That, well, I guess virtual particles can never be discovered due to their nature being virtual, but at least other particles, fields, things I don't know about.
String theory.
Yeah, very good example. Postulated, but they're, well, yeah, exactly. String theory is postulated. At some point, we will have the technological means to test it, and then we're going to see, is it true or not? But right now, we don't even have the technological methods to test it. The same was with the Higgs boson and with gravitational waves, because we didn't have a kilometer-long interferometer, and we did not have these energies it needed in the Hadron Collider to discover the Higgs boson.
I mean, it's sort of the same for quantum computing. People have postulated that quantum computing will be really awesome for doing certain types of molecular modeling. Is apparently going to be very, is going to be very powerful for doing cryptography. Is also one of those things which should be, you should be able to break a lot of passwords very, very quickly. But we still don't know if that's going to be true. The computers we've made. Quantum computers we've made currently are very, very primitive. They only contain a certain number of qubits. I think it's up to the hundreds now, but it's very small. So you can't really... we still don't know whether quantum computing will be as good as people have said it would be. And it may actually be really rubbish.
Have you been missing something, Ashley?
Hmm?
In that list of discoveries, have you been missing a specific one?
So at least in the epidemiological and genetic side of things, I would say probably kind of the coolest advancement was sort of the doing away with candidate gene studies and moving towards genome-wide association studies. That's been a really cool advancement because none of the candidate gene studies actually replicated during like 2000 to 2010. It was probably about when they were popular.
Can you really tell me what those are?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just about to do that, and now I will do it. Okay, so back in the day, we used to think that, you know, it was mostly maybe like one or two genes caused a psychiatric disorder. And really, one or two genes causing a disorder is actually very quite rare, and it's only true for a small number of diseases. But in reality, when you have something really complex like a mental illness or other diseases, it's actually several different small places on the gene or in the whole human genome that add together to create your risk or probability for developing an illness, such as mental health issues. And so back in the day, it was really super expensive to analyze the whole genome. So we would just have to pick out these small little snippets. And also back in the day, there wasn't so much interest in collaboration. Scientists wanted to be the first people that discovered something. They did not want to share the credit. So people had what were quite large data sizes at the time. But now we kind of look back and laugh of like, you know, a couple hundred to a couple thousand people. And they said, okay, so we're interested in learning about depression. We have a feeling it has to do with serotonin. So we're just going to pick out, you know, this part of the genome that's related to serotonin. We're just going to see if we find an effect between those that have this disorder and those that do not. And so that's how we hypothesized that, oh, the 5-HTTPLR gene, oh, that's related to depression. If you have this long version of the 5-HTTPLR gene, then you have depression. But later we went back and we found out that's actually not true. A lot of those were false findings, simply because the sample size wasn't big enough. And nowadays we no longer do those studies. Nowadays we look at the whole genome and we put all of our data sources together. So, you know, the UK has a really big biobank, for example, Sweden, we have the Swedish Twin Register, and there's different genetic researchers all around the world. And in 2007, actually, the largest working consortium started. It's called the Psychiatric Genomics Consortium, and it's the largest working group of researchers in the world, which is really cool from any field. Yeah, and it's so awesome that it's in the field of psychiatry, which is often the bastard field of all of science. And through this wonderful large consortium, we've been able to find out some really cool discoveries, like that there's of course none of the candidate gene studies replicated, and that there's many different small genes that aggregate to create your risk of developing a mental illness. And like I said, although this consortium started quite late in the, like I said, like 2007, it's really quite cool the advancements we've made. Another cool thing that it's a little bit too early to say is the advancements of antidepressants. So very, very recently, there was approval for ketamine for antidepressant use. And what is so...
Ketamine is a street drug, right?
Ketamine is a street drug, yes.
A friend of mine
has a horse tranquilizer.
A friend of yours.
A friend of mine has some horses that need tranquilizer.
Yeah, exactly.
Ketamine is a horse tranquilizer.
Originally, it was developed as a horse tranquilizer.
And then people started like, I guess this tea is nice.
Yeah.
Sure. So needles that I get.
It wasn't a needle. No, they snorted it.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. A friend snorted it.
Yeah. I would never do such a thing, but a friend, not even a friend, a friend of a friend. Sure. A friend of a friend heard one, so you can snort ketamine. No, yeah. So the pharmaceutical company, for whatever reason, took an interest in it, and they found that it actually has, lo and behold, antidepressant effects. But this isn't maybe so novel or that interesting outside of itself. But what's cool about it is that it is the fastest acting antidepressant ever, I'm just going to go ahead and say. So most typical antidepressants start working maybe like a couple weeks after they're given. It takes a very long time. But ketamine works within hours. And the effects are quite striking. And of course, there's a lot that still needs to be done, that we still need to learn about exactly how it works and exactly what are the long-term side effects of being on it, like at a level that a doctor would give you, so to say. And of course, there's the potentiality for abuse, and I could go on and on. And so I want to be really cautious about my excitement with this. But what's so cool is that we found a fast-acting antidepressant. Because if you're suicidal, you're suicidal right now. I mean, 6 weeks, you could be dead. So that's pretty cool, I think.
Just to be clear, it's not just being used as a tranquilizer. Like, of course, you're not super suicidal if you're asleep.
That's true. You can't be suicidal if you're asleep. No, they give it to you in a much smaller dose than your friend of a friend was taking in a club, I'm sure.
Hey, don't bring my friend of a friend.
It's approved through a nasal spray as well, and it's approved only in the U.S. and it's called esketamine, and the doctor has to administer it. They're not letting anybody take it out of the hospital right now, to my knowledge, and it'll probably stay like that at least for the foreseeable future. And I'm hoping that it'll be approved in Sweden soon, because it's really sort of a quote-unquote breakthrough in treatment, because we haven't had this type of advancement in treatment in a very long time. So, because most of the drugs that we use are actually from, like, the 80s or 90s, or even...
So the 1950s saw the release of the first wave of antidepressants, but a majority of those drugs are no longer used. The first selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI, was synthesized in the 1980s. So from the 1980s onwards, you have the release of the drugs that we now use today.
And based on this outdated theory called the monoamine theory, which basically means that you have, you know, not enough serotonin or too much serotonin or something, and that theory is, it's largely incorrect, and we know that now. But our treatment options have not kept up with the advancements in theory.
Just, that was really cool. I hadn't known about ketamine being used in that way, but you mentioned the potential for abuse. One thing I'm fascinated by is street chemistry. So we've all watched Breaking Bad and all of the whole like making up methamphetamines from different synthetic routes and stuff like that, and the whole show was made about that. But people who want to get high find, it's mainly opiates, they find them in the most amazing commercial products, and then extract them and perform proper organic chemistry on them, and then inject themselves with the results. And if say the ketamine based nasal spray got out into wide use, I would be super intrigued to see how people concentrate up the ketamine levels so that they can begin to inject it and get high. Because no matter what, people will find a way.
Oh, it'll happen.
It's inevitable.
It's really just a matter of time. I mean, before it just gets released on the street. And I mean, that's definitely one of the issues there.
I don't know if it is, if I may interrupt.
Yeah, no, go for it. Yeah.
I think the actual issue might be the prohibition here. I don't know how you guys are on your stand on prohibition on drugs and if this is a good thing or not. I personally think it's not a great thing. And I think the example of Portugal has shown that the complete legalization of basically everything has benefited society a lot. And by not criminalizing the abuse, people wouldn't have to extract it from nasal spray, but just buy the fucking spray and then get high of it, and then it's fine. Maybe it is fine. There are definitely a bunch of drugs where this is not fine. It comes down to the question if the lawmakers can make it illegal to destroy your own body or not. That's completely different question. But I don't think it comes down to, or the question is what, how people will get to the compound. The question is how will this be handled legally and in society? Because maybe the drug itself is not going to be a big issue, since I don't think it was so far. At least I haven't heard of it on a large scale.
I would just like to quickly add that you should not self-medicate with ketamine, especially the ketamine that you find on the street, for multiple reasons. Reason one, if you are feeling depressed or suicidal, you should go and seek help from a medical professional. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is that you don't know the proper dose that you need. The third thing I want to say is right now you'd be getting it from the street. And so there's no real way to guarantee that what you're getting is the pure and proper ketamine that you can get. And there's also some really negative side effects, such as seizures and psychosis and things like that. So really strongly, even if you hear it and you are depressed and you feel like, oh, I'll just buy some ketamine, don't do that.
Yeah, to follow on with that, I'm obsessed with street chemistry and the things people are doing to get drugs and make drugs, but it tends to be very, very shitty, and you end up with a lot of horrible, horrible things. There's a drug, it's very popular in Russia, called Crocodile.
Oh, yeah!
It's horrible. I'm not exactly sure. It's an opioid-based drug, but it's made in a way which creates a very caustic solution. And then when you inject it, it causes your skin to crust up and look like crocodile skin, hence its name. And that stuff is foul. If there's any like advertisement for not doing drugs, I'm close to Hannes on in a philosophical sense about legalization of drugs. But personally, I would not take, as a chemist, I would not take street drugs because of what could be inside them.
Due to side products and shitty purification, or because of the actual drug?
Yeah, because of side products, so side products and shitty purification.
And your crocodile, what's it called?
Crocodile. Google search crocodile. You know, not on a full stomach, and
or maybe don't,
or not at work.
Yeah, definitely not at work in any case.
Yeah, there's two different issues: the purification, how well it's done, or if the molecule itself, the compound itself, is super harmful, like this crocodile. or other things. I guess there's two separate issues in a way. But in any way, I'm completely on your side. I'd rather have legalized drugs for everyone who wants them. And I'm not one of them. Just for the protocol here, I don't want to take any drugs. I'm fine without. But
damn, that was what we're going to do later.
I do like some paracetamol, I have to say.
So, to go back though, one of the things that is so sad about all of this is that because of the ban on psychoactive substances and things that cause the brain to do something interesting and change in certain ways, there has been a huge lack of research into compounds that affect the brain. And so, actually, you being like, oh, it's amazing that we're using ketamine, it's almost a bit sad because we've wasted, I don't know, decades of research that could have been done by drugs companies on psychoactive compounds, because legally it's just so difficult. And it's funny that ketamine's now become cool in psychology circles, but it's almost a failure of legislation that has caused this.
I would absolutely agree. I think also the ban of cannabis, or the difficulty in researching cannabis, is also an issue. I mean, we're seeing this really horrible opioid crisis, and I think in part that could have been a bit mitigated, if not fixed, by research into cannabis and CBD for pain. For example, I mean, cannabis is still an addictive substance, but I mean, it's way less addictive than opioids, and it has way less serious side effects compared to opioids. So I mean here that THC in cannabis can be psychologically addicting. Marijuana is not physically addicting. Additionally, also now we're seeing a rise in psychedelic research in the treatment of PTSD, depression, and things like that. And I mean, if it was any other drug other than what it is, we would have already been funding really large-scale studies, because at the small-scale level, it is showing to be very effective for these really complex-to-treat disorders. Again, under the watch of a trained psychologist, and this is in the context of psychotherapy, this is not just taking a bunch of LSD with your friends in a dark basement. Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways the legality and just the stigma surrounding both these drugs, and also maybe the illnesses themselves that they're trying to treat, is it hampers the progress of science, and it hampers the progress of this really complex group getting treated.
I think it's also sad because who knows what we could make drug. We can make drugs safer. We can make drugs non-addictive, but also to cause, say, the psychedelic effects.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're missing out on some part of human existence by not being able to experience these crazy effects, and it's a bit sad.
Yeah, I think a core argument is that, or is just what we observed, that independently of how illegal you make a drug, some people will take them. Some people will keep taking them. No matter the fallout of that. So I'm kind of stunned by how you can just ignore that and keep criminalizing them, saying, well, there's something wrong with the person, other than there might be something wrong with the way we approach this entire issue.
Mm-hmm.
This to finally wrap up this topic, maybe to add to one of the pieces of research of the last decade, there was a really nice study using mice where they showed that if they gave opioids in a water bottle to mice, so they gave a choice to the mice between an opioid water bottle and just a plain water bottle, and for mice kept in a very boring, horrible cage with drab food, with a shit mouse existence, they tended to drink more from the opioid water bottle. But when they gave them an enhanced existence with mice to play with, to form relationships with, and balls and toys and a bigger cage with like outdoor areas, they took much, much less. And in fact, I think no opioid-laced water. And so your addiction to drugs is not based on the addictiveness of the drug itself, but also on your existence and the how your life is going at the time.
Mm-hmm.
These claims have to be done very carefully, for sure, especially if it's between animal models and direct correlation to human life. Very carefully. I think there's some value in this, absolutely. but maybe we shouldn't conclude lifestyle advices from a mouse experiment. I do see your point, though, and I do think there's a lot to it.
But if you have a mouse addicted to heroin, you should give it more toys.
Well,
to wean it off.
I'm definitely going to take this away from it without any grain of salt here. Okay, we have energy for one more topic. Ashley, you're not in the picture, but Chris and I have been talking about this for over fika. Which is the Swedish word for coffee break. Many times, and with many people so far, actually. I've been harassing a lot of people with this idea. Do you want to start? You want to introduce it?
Yeah. So it comes up a bit on... there's a lot of this on the internet anyway, about like what would you take back if you could have a time machine?
It's not our idea. Well, okay, different story. Sure.
Yeah. This is debated a lot.
Time machine.
So the question is usually, what would you take back if you're going back in time? What would you take back with you? But we're scientists here, so we're going to go back time and hopefully not change our profession. I hope we enjoy what we're doing. So if you're a scientist, you went back in time, what could you discover, or what would you discover, or when would you go back?
Okay, my philosophical thought on this was a bit different. Same outcome, though. My idea was, we are a scientist and we claim to have very specific knowledge in a certain field. Let's say chemistry, in my case, biochemistry stuff. And these fields are quite advanced. Chemistry is often still very...
It's basic. Just say basic. Still consulting my field. Why does it always happen?
It's very basic.
I thought it was acidic. Why does it...
No. Jeez.
From one joke per podcast.
Yeah. That's our limit.
So what skills would you bring to start over with your field in past period of human history? What could you do with the technology present to start over with your field? Or to do anything, actually. Anything that wasn't obvious to the people then. And this, of course, depends on what period you would choose, I guess. I would exclude the last 300 years or so.
Oh, wow, that's quite far. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Go back further. Maybe not just Stone Age, right? Because, I mean, they didn't even have anything that you could do stuff with. Like, no glass. So chemistry is kind of out of the question.
I mean, but yeah, I could bring them glass. That would be awesome.
How would you make glass?
I get a lot of fire, and I get some sand.
And it just melted and make glass. Is that all
that's
it takes?
Pretty much what sand is. There's some...
And you think your cave fire is going to be hot enough to melt sand?
Well, I could invent charcoal to start with and then keep
going. How do you make charcoal?
You burn wood in a oxygen-limited environment.
Make one of these pits, right?
Yeah, it's actually quite easy to make charcoal. I mean, you end up with charcoal if you just put your fire out before it's done doing. But there are more efficient ways to make charcoal. So that's your starting point. You can make some charcoal, and then you can start making fires that are hotter than average. And once you've started to get to hot fires, you can start melting... sand to make glass, or metals to begin to produce axes and these sorts of things.
So charcoal fires are hotter than wood fires?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Well, yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Have you ever made your own charcoal?
I have not made my own charcoal.
Do you want to do that sometime?
I do. I definitely
want to make my own. We should actually make our own charcoal.
Oh, that's one of the most boring things, one of the most boring home projects I've ever heard of.
What do you mean?
I want to make soap.
Oh, we could, you know what? We could absolutely do that. It's quite easy to do.
Yep,
we just need to get some animal fat.
Every great adventure starts with, we need to get some animal fat. We need to get some animal fat.
Before we do this, we need to do, but yeah, can you actually make vegan soap? How do you make vegan soap?
Coconut oil.
Yeah, plant-based oils.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Mm.
Well, yeah, I mean...
I'm using a great hemp-based soap that I found in Basel. It's amazing.
Oh.
It's really good. It's got CBD in it.
Yeah, we should actually, though, make some lavender soap. I'm, very into lavender right now.
Okay, so we've got soap and charcoal. Glass, potentially.
You would make glass. That's interesting. I think what I would try to do is... to step into the field of microbiology, which I have never did so far, other than brewing beer at home, which is a lot of fun, and making bread.
Mm.
And what I think I could do is maybe make some antibiotics.
bold move, I
bold
think.
Bold move, I think.
Yeah.
Sugar? Or would you just use sugar? What would you use?
What do you mean,
sugar? Doesn't sugar kill bacteria?
Well, at a high enough concentration, yeah. Sure. But it's not really feasible.
I mean, you just pour a shit ton of like salt on somebody's wound or
what if they have blood infection?
Well, I mean, if there's like a... some sort of skin. Never mind. This
no,
is
no,
not
like,
my field.
It's superficial infections.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's yeah, a total.
Yeah.
Almost whatever. You pack sugar around the wound, it kills the stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For blood infection, this is like the worst thing. Once someone cut themselves on a rusty nail, the person was done for good.
Yeah.
And I guess the way I would go about this is by growing mold on bread.
Loads of things. The reason I'm skeptical is because it was the first antibiotics were discovered by chance, and you might not be guaranteed to find the right molds.
But now I know what I'm looking for. I can make an assay by growing bacteria from someone's wound pus, and that's the bacteria I want to kill, right? I guess. And then growing mold somehow. Extracting metabolites, some kind of lysis procedure, and dipping in onto whatever agar plates I will have then. And I guess this way I can test for antibiotics.
I mean, so...
I know what I'm looking for right now, right?
What's
it called? Nicholas Fleming?
Actually, Alexander Fleming.
Yeah, I mean, you can jump
you
one...
Didn't know what
you can avoid one step by growing the mold on the same plate. And that was how he saw it, because he
right,
saw the
right.
mold colony grow out and kill off the bacteria around
yes.
it. The only thing was that the jump between that discovery and the use of antibiotics was there's a lot of like hard research done all the way along, and the main one was the scaling up of synthesis, and that was actually really really tricky.
I don't think we'd have to synthesize it, at least not at a time scale back then, right? I guess well, I think growing mold and eating it, the right kind of mold, is already a big step. When fighting an actual serious infection.
I disagree.
Do you disagree?
I don't think eating mold... Please do not eat moldy bread if you've got a cold or something.
Actually, cold is
a viral infection. But anyway, about any bacterial infection, please do not start eating moldy bread. That is
absolutely
the worst
not.
How else
ever.
Will you meet the witches?
Yeah. The other thing is, so that's actually a really good point. It's like, how do you convince... So let's say you're right, and eating... When you eat the mold... you eat enough of the antibiotic to cause a significant decrease in the number of bacteria in your body, which is where I think the problem lies. You're working in a society which doesn't believe in the scientific method and doesn't understand your credentials as a PhD student from the KI. So, how do you?
Probably would not understand my language.
Well, that as well.
Maybe in specific parts of medieval Germany, but otherwise.
Okay, well, you can bring Google Translate with you. it's fine. There's internet connection.
But then can I also
just make sure you download the ancient German.
Ancient German, yeah. Anyway,
Christopher, please.
How would you convince a society of your invention, given that there are potentially witches and wizards? Do you claim yourself to be a wizard or a priest to get it done, actually?
So what you do is you become a charlatan. You start knowing all these historical events, and then you start throwing them out there. Like, oh yeah, today, you know, this is the date before this import, the what was it, the Gutenberg printing press? Wasn't that in Germany? What was going on in Germany back in the day?
Luther.
Which day? A lot of stuff. That's one
yeah.
event. 14,
yeah.
91,
so yeah, you just start throwing out stuff. You're like, oh yes, you do claim that you you have this ability to just know all inherent things, and then you just start throwing out these like fun historical scientific or historical dates that you know.
But they're true.
And then they're true. Yes, they're true. But it's not because you have the ability to foresee the future. It's just because you already know them, which is why you're a charlatan. And then they believe you. So then you start inventing antibiotics. And that's how you get them to listen.
Very nice. Difficult. I think with the entire premise of what could you do when going back in time and using their ancient technology, this is the argument that always comes up. And this is going to be inevitably difficult in any way. Most of the time, I think you would just end up dying. Because they would, oh, who's that guy? How did he... Well, I think if you start curing people, maybe you're fine. But if you do anything else, they're going to kill you.
my favorite anti-time machine idea is the fact that if you go back in time, the Earth is no longer in the same place as where you are, so you just fall into space, and that thought experiment's dead. So, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty fun. That's fun.
Great.
Do we need an end?
Sorry?
We might need an ending piece.
Should we come up with like a cute science thing? Like a really uplifting science thing?
Yes, I have one.
Okay, what is it?
I have uplifting science news.
Oh, what's uplifting science news?
Have you seen the video of rats driving cars?
Oh, let's talk about the video of rats driving cars,
this
actually.
This is amazing.
Okay.
Researchers have managed to get rats to drive cars. So the rats are in little remote control vehicles where they're sat on a metal aluminium plate and there are three wires in front of them. And if they put their hand on one wire, it creates a connection and the car registers that as turning left, right, or going forwards. And they then drive the car towards a target and they get a treat. But at the same time, the researchers were studying the metabolites in the poo of the rats, and they identified like serotonin, and like the rats were really happy when they got their treat. But then the researchers took away the treat but left the cat rats in the car, and the rats drove the car around separately to getting treats, and they still enjoyed driving the car around. So it wasn't just torturing, it was... So happy science fact of the day.
Oh, little rat babies.
Yeah.
That actually does relate with my spirits.
Amazing. Great story.
Less children live in poverty now than ever before.
But rats are driving cars.
But rats are driving cars, yes.
I can show us a video. It's so helpful in podcast. I think this is just how we ended. See you next time. Bye. I want to see them close up. Can you believe that? It's insane. Oh my god. We're like this close away from them operating lorries on the highway.
It's Ratatouille. Yes. Oh my god. It's a little baby.
Yeah. We're gonna end this now.
And during a quick bathroom break, Chris actually found some things on the tetraether lead chemist that he just chats about. He was not thinking this was gonna go on the podcast, that's why there's a lot of background noise. Please excuse that.
I found the guy who made the tetraether lead.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he did. He made tetraether lead and CFCs, but the Wikipedia article on him is, like, terrifying.
What, really?
So, tetraether lead was discovered by a German chemist in the, like, 1980s or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it was useless. Like, no one did anything until this guy discovered that it's useful for anti-knocking in engines.
Mm-hmm.
So, he discovered it and talked to General Motors, and in 1923 he had to take a long vacation to cure himself of lead poisoning because he needed fresh air from all the lead poisoning he was getting. He tried to make a company along with GM, which was slowly failing because there were two deaths and several cases of lead poisoning in the prototype plant that they were using. GM got pissed off and started another company, which was within the first 2 months of its operation plagued by more cases of lead poisoning, hallucinations, insanity, and five deaths. Then there was a press conference where this guy Midgley, who already had shown that who had only gone on holiday to get rid of the lead in his body, he wanted to demonstrate that tetraether lead was safe. So he poured it over his hands and held it under his nose at a press conference in order to get it used in society. And then he went on and made CFCs. So,
oh my god,
he's pretty
what
bad.
A hero.
At this point, it's just Chris chewing chips until the rest of the episode, so you might as well just go ahead and select the next episode to listen to. I'm serious, there's nothing coming up at this point. Just select the next episode and go for it. Nothing here.